Hello, Bloodstream Podcast listeners. It is host Patrick here. Before we jump into the episode, episode 43, which is unbelievable. The amount of episodes we've done of this, of Ask the Expert, and the growing Bloodstream Media Network, it's quite a lot to sit back and take in sometimes. But here we are, episode 43, the last one of 2019. We've got an interview with Alex Borstein, who's out promoting The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, and we talk with her about that and how the tour is going and some of the fun that she's been having on that and some of the more repetitive and not so fun parts of it too. She talks about that. And we've got a story covering the Parent Empowerment newsletter. Their story, Paul Clement authored for the November issue, the cover story on gene therapy clinical trials. Natalie and I cover aspects of that article and point you to it and to the valuable takeaways from it during our comments segment. She covers a piece on depression during the holidays and the like segment. So a lot to get to, but I did want to come back on after we finished recording because it was just announced that the National Hemophilia Foundation's board of directors has appointed Dawn Rodolini as the interim chief executive officer of NHF. Dawn has been a leader in the community for quite some time, first with the Rocky Mountain Hemophilia and Bleeding Disorders Association in Montana, then on to serve in the family camp. She has background to the American Diabetes Association, and for the last 11 years, she's been working for NHF, most recently promoted to the Senior Vice President of Program Development. She is also a member of the Board of Directors for the World Federation of Hemophilia. So, big announcement that Dawn will be the interim CEO as NHF enters this transitional phase. Congratulations to Dawn, and congratulations to the community. I think that's a really good thing for us. Also wanted to announce, Bloodstream has launched another new podcast, Bloodstream Journeys, covering the moments of decision, that single fraction of a second where you could go on repeating the mistakes of the past or ripping open a brand new future for yourself. These are bleeding disorders community stories of love, laughs, life, death, syringes, and everything else. True stories told for and by the community from Bloodstream Media and made possible exclusively by BioMarin. So head on over to Bloodstream Journeys. Look up Bloodstream Journeys on Apple Pods or wherever you listen to podcasts, or head to the new website. We've got a brand new website, bloodstreammedia.com, where you'll find links to listen to and subscribe to Bloodstream Journeys, to Cheat Codes, the new sickle cell podcast. You're going to hear more about that a little later, or to Ask the Expert if you're still lagging behind there. The Bloodline feed, I've got a lot to offer. So head on over to bloodstreammedia.com. Lastly, last year about this time, we covered some of the takeaways from ASH, the American Society of Hematology's annual meeting, which takes place every December, or at least it has taken place every December the last many years. It's a very medical heavy conference. It's not really community focused in the way that, say, HFA Symposium or even NHF's annual meeting is very community focused. ASH is not. But there's interesting medical interesting medical takeaways that come out of that conference. If you're interested and active on social media, I'd recommend checking out the hashtag #ASH19, hashtag #ASH19 on Twitter, or look up the American Society of Hematology's website, and you can find links as well to their social pages, which have more takeaways specifically in real time from the conference. So just wanted to point you in that direction as well. And with that, please enjoy episode 43, the last of December 2019 of the Bloodstream Podcast.
The presenting sponsor of the Bloodstream podcast is Takeda. And for that, we say thanks, Takeda.
Hello and welcome to the Bloodstream Podcast, episode 43, December 16th, 2019. I am Patrick James Lynch.
And I'm Natalie Lynch.
On this episode, at least 10 gene therapy clinical trials are enrolling hemophilia patients. But what exactly is the clinical trial process, and what do you need to know about gene therapy trials? Paul Clement's insightful article from the November Parent Empowerment newsletter from LA Kelly Communications breaks it down, and we will discuss in today's comment segment. The holidays are a lovely time to manage depression, aren't they? Natalie reviews a Headline.com article on the topic, and actor, comedian, and community member Alex Borstein returns to Bloodstream to talk about the newest season of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, now available on Amazon. All that, plus Natalie and I share our favorite holiday movies, Mama Sue shares her opinions, and more. Coming up on this episode, welcome to Bloodstream. Big, exciting news, Natalie Rose.
What?
We have a new website.
I haven't looked at it yet, if I'm being completely honest.
Really?
Yeah.
Pull it up right now.
I'm
Bloodstreammedia.com.
Okay.
It's looking slick and strong with access to links for all of our shows, including the newest one, Cheat Codes, a Sickle Cell Podcast. led by expert hosts Dr. Amar Zaidi and Dr. Mike Callahan from the Comprehensive Sickle Cell Center at the Children's Hospital of Michigan. Each episode of Cheat Codes, a Sickle Cell podcast, brings you a series of segments packed with critical information and, critical education and research information that patients and families need to know. I wrote this. I should be able to read it. As well as updates and clarifications from the social media buzz around sickle cell. Cheat Codes, a Sickle Cell podcast, also features interviews with leading experts, moments from major conferences, and contributions from people living with sickle cell, all while Dr. Z and Dr. Mike keep the show fresh, fun, and off the cuff. You can download the first three episodes right now to hear about topics such as cannabis use, gene therapy, hydroxyurea, hemoglobin, penicillin, nutrition, and so much more. So check out bloodstreammedia.com, just like Natalie is right now, and follow the links to Cheat Codes, a Sickle Cell podcast, or subscribe to Cheat Codes, a Sickle Cell podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts.
You really like saying that whole title.
Well, look, there are other Cheat Code podcasts out there, so I'm trying to specify. We are Cheat Codes, a Sickle Cell podcast. Orange little logo. Did you pull up the website?
I did, and speaking of orange, it's very orange.
Well, the Cheat Codes is.
Yeah, and that's what's front and center right now.
Right, and then scroll through, you see the most recent Ask the Expert podcast, right?
When very that one
features
intuitive.
Dr. Michael Wong, so you can hear Dr. Michael Wong on Ask the Expert talk about the current status of revolutionary potential treatments like gene therapy and non-factory placements. You can find that as well on bloodstreammedia.com. Look at Natalie's reading the description right now as we speak.
There's me.
And if there's a topic that you want to hear about, a guest you'd like to hear from, or if you're interested in contributing to Bloodstream in some way, let us know. Facebook.com/bloodstreammedia, @bloodstreaminfo on Twitter and on Instagram, or email us mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com. Also, Bloodstream Media and Believe Limited are currently casting for numerous story-driven projects that we are producing in 2020, including a video series on professional advancement, a podcast series built around pain, and a documentary film on mental health and bleeding disorders, and so much more. So if you are interested, again, email us mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com with the word casting, all caps, casting, in the subject line.
Do you have to say it like that while you type it?
You can. It helps to remember it's all caps if you go casting.
True, true.
Really helpful. Natalie, did we cover all the housekeeping we needed to?
I think so.
You ready to do it?
I mean, it's the holiday episode, so I'm really excited.
It is the holiday episode. You're going to share with us your favorite three movies by the end, as am I, in the parting shot
segment. All
right,
I'll start thinking about them now.
Is it going to be like your list of soups where your top three favorites is actually like 25 long?
I don't know if we have to tell everyone about that. But.
Fun fact, if you ask Natalie what her top three soups are, she'll give you a list of about 20 some odd soups. So just be prepared for that.
I love soup.
You actually
and
just
it's that time
soup.
Of the year too. It's soup. It's the soup time.
It's soup time of the year all the time for you. But yes, in general, cold is soup time. Let's get on to the like segment.
All right.
Now, before we start the like segment, I want to thank this month's sponsor, Genentech. Now, you probably know the impact of bleeding disorders goes beyond whether your blood will clot. There are both social and psychological burdens that affect people living with hemophilia. Recently, Genentech partnered with the University of Pennsylvania's Positive Psychology Center to develop two unique workshops. These 90-minute sessions are practical, science-based programs specifically designed to help members of the hemophilia community develop their cognitive and emotional skills to thrive in spite of the challenges associated with bleeding disorders. Your Genentech Hemophilia Community Clinical Educator can help you attend one of these interactive workshops. Clinical educators are a team of individuals with nursing degrees who are dedicated to being an educational and informational resource. You can connect with your local clinical educator by calling 1-866-436-5427. Again, that is 1-866-436-5427.
So for this month's like segment, I am bringing an article from Healthline.com by Sam Dylan Finch, who is a journalist and media strategist who has published extensively on mental health. The article's titled "Crazy Talk: I'm Afraid My Depression Will Ruin Everyone's Holiday."
I have had that thought.
Well, you would not be alone because, fun fact, anxiety during the holidays has something like 88 million results on Google.
Whew. Wow. A lot of people searching for anxiety on the holidays.
Yeah. So you're certainly not alone. 88 million.
Cool. I might be like 8 million of those, but there's still a lot of other people, obviously.
So 'tis the season that asks a lot of us. Sam goes into the article talking about holiday times, unspoken expectations, such as being more social, more gracious, more joyful. And, you know, he lists a few other things too, like being financially stable enough to buy gifts.
Oh, well, I was actually, yeah, so that's a big one. I was also going to jokingly just say like more handsome, but actually that's kind of true too, right? Like sometimes we don't see people except for the holiday times and you want to like
look
your best.
People get their hair cut, colored,
right.
A new outfit for the holiday time.
Which is like good, but also can come with additional stressors and anxiousness.
Yeah. And you know, it also tends to be the time of year where you're packing on more pounds.
Funny how that works out, isn't it?
So when you're already hitting your mental and emotional limits, trying to manage everyone else's expectations of you is a lot to ask. Mm-hmm. So Sam has some advice.
Sam, what do you got for us, buddy?
He said that you should stay at home or shorten your trip only if you want to. If the holidays are going to worsen your mental health, not going is a valid choice to make. But if you're afraid of being with family just because you don't want to burden them, then the truth is your presence is a gift to the people who truly love you. Because the reason for the season is just being together.
So don't use that as a reason not to go, but at the same time.
If you're afraid, you're like, I'm in a real dark place, and if I go, it's really going to bring everyone down.
Right.
It's not.
Yeah, bogus,
right. People who love you want you to be there.
Right. On the other hand, right.
You know, it is a valid reason if you think attending is going to worsen your state and, you know, that there might be some further mental health implications by forcing yourself into that experience.
Yeah, you probably only have the responsibility in that case to communicate clearly with whomever it would be appropriate to communicate with that, you know, either you're not going to go or you might be late or you're coming in a day late or leaving a day early, right?
Yeah.
Communication is probably the only thing you really owe anybody.
At that point,
At that point, and not too much of it either.
And depression isn't contagious, and perhaps spending some time with people you love may be a welcome distraction from a low state.
That's a very good point.
And so if you decide that going is what you want to do,
I'm going to
support your mental health.
It's going to support my mental
health. You're going to go. So Sam has some shortcuts to making time with family more manageable.
Okay.
So his first tip is movies are your friend. Not feeling social? Pop on a classic holiday movie.
Love it.
And you can stay in the mix. You can pop it on in the living room. People are still around, but you know, you don't have the pressure of socially engaging.
2 hours of no talking, then you can talk about the movie for an hour, and we'll give you our movie recommendations later in case you're running out of some.
Tip number two, games are great distractions.
Agreed.
And there can be, you know, you can do simple games. One of his suggestions is Heads Up, and you can play it with...
What's Heads Up?
I believe there's an app with your phone, something like you put your phone on your head, there's a word, people have to guess it.
Yeah.
I think there's also a physical card there are, you know, versions of... If you won a game, but you didn't bring one or no one has one, that's a good way to...
That's clever.
Yeah, download an app or go online and...
Or throw a pack of cards in your travel bag and, you know, come ready to play like one, you know, we play golf or some version of... Can you play Go Fish with regular playing cards? No, that's like a specific kind of thing.
No, I think you can play with regular as well.
There's all kinds. Just throw a pack of cards in there.
And so those are ways to stay socially engaged, but not necessarily be rehashing the same conversations you always have or potentially getting triggered in certain ways.
Change up the dynamics a little bit, you know, with games and teams and things like that.
Yeah. And it creates new memories too.
For sure. Absolutely.
Changes it up. Teams people up.
We talk about that kind of stuff all the time, right? You talk about like, the Pictionary game that we played or, you know, that game of like hide and go seek with the kids. Like those are always the things you talk about at subsequent events down the road.
Yeah.
What else does Sam say?
So if you need to get out of the mix, take a break. Go on a short walk, take a shower, phone a friend. But you absolutely have the right to just step away and breathe and collect yourself and come back refreshed. Another tip Sam has is to stay sober if you can.
Okay.
That alcohol is a depressant. And while it may seem like having a drink or two might make things more manageable, it actually it has a greater chance of worsening your situation.
Yeah, if you're going in feeling particularly anxious or particularly depressive, chances are alcohol is not going to improve the situation.
No, and a lot of times if you're going in feeling those ways, it tends to not be a drink or two you end up having.
Correct.
So it may just cause bigger problems for you.
Interesting.
The next tip is use the buddy system. And he suggests setting up a support group, support chat, group text with people who also are visiting their families or friends or, you know, people who understand your situation.
Kind of in a similar spot. Yeah, understand maybe they're in a similar spot, offer each other support, that kind of thing.
Or comic relief.
Yeah, that's true. That's helpful. That's
sharing
helpful.
Stories.
Yeah, big time.
And then his last tip is set and keep boundaries. And while you can't always control how others will react to the boundaries that you set, going in and kind of thinking ahead of time, maybe even writing them out before you go, will help keep them clear and just make you feel safe.
For sure. Writing them out is a big, you know, I had a therapist once who made that point of like, prepare to tell the story. So let's say hypothetical, you know, you recently lost your job or left your job or something. You know, you're going to go home and your uncle or your aunt or whomever is going to ask you about that and you don't really want to talk about it. Well, if you know you're going to get asked about it, if you can forecast that a little bit and just come up with the one or two sentence pithy way to kind of address it and deflate it or redirect it so that it doesn't catch you off guard. I have found that to be a huge buoy in supporting me doing things socially without letting social anxiety take over. Just being prepared for those questions that like you don't want to get but can probably expect.
Sure. Yeah, it definitely helps. And then, you know, the holidays often trigger grief. Those who are no longer sitting around the table. So, you know, even if you're not in a bout of depression or battling or don't struggle with mental illness, there may be a trigger at the holidays. So these tips are really good for anyone and particularly good if you're already going into the holidays feeling a bit blue or, you know, and I don't mean that to minimize anyone's mental health issues because, you know, depression's depression, but you could be just not someone who suffers from clinical depression, but entering the holidays.
Anything can happen.
Yeah. And so depression, anxiety, grief, Sam refers to them as hitting triple cherries.
Okay.
And so, you know, you could be dealing with all three.
Yeah.
And these are great ways to set yourself up for success and have the happiest holidays you can have.
Oh, thanks, Sam. So quick tips review. Movies, games, breaks, sobriety, buddies, boundaries. Movies, games, breaks, sobriety, buddies, boundaries. Article healthline.com from Sam. You can check it out. And thank you, Natalie, for today's like segment.
You're welcome.
And that's it for this month's like segment. And we want to thank Genentech one more time for sponsoring it and for partnering with UPenn on those two unique workshops. Talk to your clinical educator for more information. 1-866-436-5427. Quick postscript to the like segment. We don't have a mental health segment with Debbie this month. The like segment today obviously being a mental health segment. So I just wanted to remind you that there is a mental health resource guide for the bleeding disorders community that was produced by Mental Health Matters 2. You can find that at Mental Health Matters 2, T-O-O, and it's all spelled out, Mental Health Matters 2, and click the resources tab to download your own copy. You can also contact Mental Health Matters 2 founder Debbie De La Riva at Debbie, D-E-B-B-I-E, at M-H-M. TOO.com. DEBBIE at MHMTOO.com.
The Bloodstream podcast is made possible by. Hey, where's my Christmas music?
Do, 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 do,
the Bloodstream do, podcast do, do, is made possible do, do, by Takeda. Did you know Takeda has designed supportive resources with you in mind? Resources such as copay assistance for eligible patients, insurance support services, and boy, do we need those, health insurance education, healthcare reform tools and resources, and phone support available Monday through Friday, 8:30 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern, that is, at 1-800-BAX-8379. Again, that's 1-888-BAX-8379. Again, that's 1-888-BAX-8379. Learn more about the resources Takeda has created for you and your family by visiting bleedingdisorders.com.
I think we nailed it. That was perfect.
Thanks, Takeda.
Okay, this month's comment segment comes to us from the Parent Empowerment Newsletter, the November edition from LA Kelly Communications. The article, the cover article rather, Volunteering for a Gene Therapy Clinical Trial? Read this first, and it's authored by frequent contributor to Penn, Paul Clement. So in broad strokes, the article kind of breaks down the clinical trials process and then gets into some of the specifics as it pertains to gene therapy. Some interesting things about the process of clinical trials. So in the U.S., it takes about 12 years for a drug on average to go from laboratory to the medicine cabinet, 12 years on average. only about one in how many drugs ever get to market. Natalie, how many drugs do you think? One in how many drugs actually get to the market?
That start
in the laboratory with an intention, but never maybe quite make it. How many?
One in 10,000.
Not bad. One in 5,000, which okay. I thought was pretty high. But yeah, one in 5,000. So the breakdown of the stages, it starts with discovery and development. So all 5,000 of the drugs that lead to one, they start with discovery and development, which is the stage at which there is a decision made about whether or not a drug is even needed. So that's the very first step. Then there's preclinical testing. How might this drug work? They try to solve as many things as they can before it's studied in humans. That all takes place in preclinical testing. And then a drug maker can submit what's called an investigational new drug application or an IND application. So if you ever see an IND application was submitted, that means that company was looking to start clinical trials. So if the IND is approved by the FDA, onto clinical trials we go. And there are four phases. So you've heard us talk about this plenty on the podcast. Phase one, phase two, phase 3B. And of course, there's all kinds of asterisks. But broadly speaking, phase one is about the safety of the drug or the device in humans. It's all about the pure safety. And that's going to be generally a smaller subset of volunteers than subsequent stages because it is still so early with the most unknowns, at least during the clinical trial process. About 70% of the drugs that enter pass phase one. Phase two is about the efficacy, which is a fancy word for effectiveness in a controlled setting of that drug or the device. About one in three drugs, or 33%, get through both phases one and two. Phase three is the largest scaled testing. The idea here is to really better understand the effectiveness, benefits, range of possibilities, and adverse reactions of that drug. In phase three, that's the largest cohort or the largest population size the clinical trial I've seen yet, because at that stage, the goal is to really better understand the effectiveness, benefits, and range of possible adverse reactions that that drug could have. This is often the time you'll hear about different cohorts, different dosing. This is when we start getting more specific with what the actual drug's behavior will be. Of the drugs that enter phase three, about 80% successfully complete it, enabling the drug maker to submit a new drug application or an NDA, which seeks FDA approval for marketing the drug. Natalie, you want to know something interesting I learned from the article?
Tell me.
Biologic drugs, such as factor concentrates, gene therapy products, vaccines, and medical products from a natural source, like a human, animal, or microorganism.
That's why they're called biologics.
You got it. Must apply not for an NDA, a new drug application, but for a BLA, a biological license application. The reason this is of interest is because, well, actually, let me first say, amongst the other differences, the BLA requires closer scrutiny of the manufacturing process and the facilities to prevent contamination by viruses or bacteria. Makes sense given the biologics in play. Once the NDA or BLA is approved, then, as said earlier, the drug is ready for marketing. What this reminded me of was when emicizumab was being considered by the FDA back in 2017, I remember hearing people say, you know, it's being considered by a different area in the FDA. It's not the same as with factor. And I didn't really know what that meant at the time. I was like, I don't really know anything about how the FDA works. Well, now I can appreciate that traditionally, factor and biologics have been approved through the BLA. But emicizumab, as a subcutaneous monoclonal antibody, would be submitted or considered through the traditional new drug application instead. So little interesting nuance there. So there you go. Put that. That's something you can share with your friends and family around the holidays. Lastly, phase four. That's often called the post-marketing surveillance. This phase, it involves the monitoring and the follow-up responsibilities related to the safety, efficacy, and the cost of the drug. The article does acknowledge, again, while on average 12 years it takes for a drug to go from the lab to the medicine cabinet, the FDA has five programs that are intended to speed up the approval process: fast track, breakthrough therapy, accelerated approval, priority review, and regenerative medicine advanced therapy designation. You can read the article for the specifics of each. The FDA does stress, of course, that these programs don't alter the scientific or medical standard for approval or the quality of the evidence required. The article also includes headlines from four of the companies who are currently in clinical trials with gene therapy products for hemophilia: uniQure, Sangamo Therapeutics, Siglion Therapeutics, and BioMarin. And it goes on to ask why people volunteer for clinical trials. In surveys of people who have participated, the top three reasons for volunteering in any clinical trial are to, one, help advance medicine, two, help improve the lives of others, and three, to help improve my condition. Kind of interesting that the first two are not necessarily about the self. also mentioned are to earn extra money and to receive free medical care. Can't blame anybody for that.
Sure.
Why do people not participate in clinical trials? Well, one of the more common reasons is simply that people don't know about them. Another reason is that people fear being injured by the treatment or of receiving a placebo, like a sugar pill, instead. Another is cost. People wonder, will my insurance pay for any additional tests that are associated with the clinical trial? Will I be reimbursed for time and travel? Another reason is inconvenience. How far is the nearest participating center from my home? Will I have to spend time in the hospital? And how often will I have to travel? You might recall we covered some of the questions that NHF suggests bringing into your doctor before considering a clinical trial, many of these same questions. The article reminds readers that you can learn about all clinical trials and their criteria at clinicaltrials.gov, and it includes, not the website, but the article rather, a list of 10 of the current gene therapy clinical trials going on and enrolling right now, along with the specific information about each. So, I highly encourage you to read the article for more information about gene therapy clinical trials, including these 10 that I just mentioned, and to learn more about the process of clinical trials themselves. It can be found in the November 2019 issue of LA Kelly Communications Penn newsletter. And if you don't receive that for free to your house, you can click the program notes to read this episode and sign up to get your own in the mail next month. Natalie, anything you'd like to add about that?
I one thing that I was thinking about is for drugs that are undergoing clinical trials for a drug that's needed for life-sustaining and life-threatening diseases and disorders, how do they manage the placebo group?
You know, I don't know the answer to that, but I can tell you that on Cheat Codes, a sickle cell podcast, in the first episode, there's a segment called the Red Blood Cell Research Review. And Dr. Mike Callahan, who's one of the hosts of that, and is actually, if that name is familiar, he did start in hemophilia and is still an active hematologist in hemophilia, though his specialty in sickle cell is the reason that I've been engaging with him. But he made the point in the episode one segment about research on penicillin. Why penicillin was so vital for children with sickle cell anemia, or sickle cell disease, rather. And what they found in the clinical trial after, I forget how long, but they had to just shut it down because the patients who were enrolled in the placebo group were getting far too sick and frankly dying. So they shut down the clinical trial and just said all patients with sickle cell should be using penicillin. So I don't know the answer to that question, but that was an example of exactly that. There was a case where, like, ugh, we just have to shut this down. It's too volatile. It's too obvious,
too risky,
in a way, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, they hadn't known that before they started.
Well, thank you, Patrick, for the comment segment. And for more information on clinical trials, what's that website again?
Clinicaltrials.gov. And if you want to take a look at the article, kellycom.com, but we'll have the link to that in the program notes. Hey, Bloodstream listeners, I mentioned earlier that BioMarin is the exclusive sponsor of a new series that we have called Bloodstream Journeys that focus on these moments of decision in the lives of members of our community. And the first episode is up now, bloodstreamjourneys.com. But we wanted to play a little teaser of it for you here so you could sample it before you head on over to subscribe to another podcast feed. In this clip, you're going to hear community member Ivan Guerons share about an experience that he had that, to put it simply, changed his life.
So I became rebellious, you know, and at the same time, I was living in a very unstable home. My father was a very violent alcoholic. And because of that, I was making a lot of poor choices in my life. I didn't have the right guidance. I continued to play sports. I sprained my ankle more times. And during high school, I was put in the PE class with the special ed kids. They didn't want me to run. I was a liability for the school, so they tried to keep me as safe as possible. But I didn't care. I kept on doing what I wanted. I got involved with gangs. I was selling drugs. I got shot twice. I actually almost lost my leg once when I got shot. I got hit on the femur and I fell to the floor right away. Paramedics get there about 5 minutes and I told them right away. I was like, I have hemophilia A. I take factor eight, 3,000 units. You guys probably need to give me a double dose. And the paramedics were like, man, we wish everybody was like this. You know, they tell us right away. But that moment taught me a valuable lesson though, because I knew that if I would have been unconscious, the paramedics wouldn't have known anything and I would have probably died. So because of that, I started wearing my medical alert every single day and I don't go anywhere without it.
To hear the rest of Ivan's story and the stories of other members from our community in their critical moments of decision, head on over to bloodstreammedia.com and click on the links to subscribe to Bloodstream Journeys, our latest show sponsored exclusively by BioMarin, or look up Bloodstream Journeys on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Well, I have the pleasure of saying that joining me now from, I believe, New York, as she's out promoting season 3 of what I believe is now a 16-time Emmy Award-winning Amazon Prime hit series, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. She's also known for her work in Family Guy and on Mad TV, and of course, as the executive producer of the documentary Bombadier Blood, actor, comedian, advocate, and bleeding disorders community member, Alex Borstein. Good morning, Alex. Are you in New York?
I am in New York right now. I'm in a hotel, and I'm actually down in the fitness center because I just had to get my fitness on.
Okay. What does that look like? What is your hotel fitness? I'm always intrigued by people who travel a lot, what their hotel fitness game is.
You know, it's just I came down here and ran on the treadmill.
Okay, the treadmill. I got
a couple miles on the treadmill, and then I'll do a few push-ups and a few sit-ups, and that's it.
And then how early are these days, these promotional days, what do they even look like? What, are they long and just repetitive, or are they really spaced out oddly? What's the rhyme and rhythm? Is there even one?
They're pretty long. You know, they usually put us up in a hotel, and then they have the press junket in the hotel, which at least is very nice because you don't have to move around all day. We go down to the floor of the hotel. They set up different outlets, radio, TV, on camera, not on camera, in different rooms, and you can go and just move from room to room. Most of the day, you're in one room, and a bunch of the journalists come in, they switch around. So they try to make it be as easy as possible, but it still is like, you know, it's 8 hours of answering pretty much the same questions. Every once in a while, you get someone that's got like a totally unique in or wants to do something a little different, and it's always wonderfully welcome. But I also get the other side of it, that, you know, each outlet is representing their readers or their viewers, and a lot of those people have the same questions. So it's part of, it's the nature of the beast. You gotta try to come up with fresh answers each time. I hate repeating over and over. I don't know if you saw that clip someone put together of Lady Gaga last year when A Star Is Born was up for all these nominations, and every single interview that she did was same line over and over, saying it just takes one person to choose you. It just takes one person to choose. It just takes one person. So you try not to do that, but sometimes it's hard.
I imagine. Yeah, I imagine. Are you doing those 8-hour days primarily on your own agenda? Or do you have yours and like Rachel's and other castmates? Are you intersecting throughout the day? Does that help keep it varied as well?
You know that we get paired. Rachel and I like to do the interviews together. So we do a bulk of them on camera together. It's more fun.
That's nice.
You can ping pong and joke around a little, and you get a little break. And if she's talking and I'm able to think for a second, and then I can maybe come up with something. And then when I'm talking, she's able to think for a second. So I think it makes for better responses, and it's more fun. But some things you do solo, especially a lot of the phone ones, then you'll go into a room where you're just locked in a room with a phone for about an hour and do one after the other of the international ones. And those are really hard because there's always a delay.
That's awkward. Yeah.
A thick accent plus a delay and a crappy connection. Tonight I'll be on the Seth Meyers show, and then that'll be it. And then I'm off to London to do a live show for 5 shows.
Oh, fun. Have you been on the Seth Meyers show before?
No, I haven't. I really don't do any, I don't do any talk shows. This is a weird first.
That's cool. Do you have is that interesting to you as a first, or does it feel somewhat routine just because you're in the midst of such a, what I imagine is a somewhat relentless schedule, or does it stand out because it is a first of sorts?
It just makes me nervous. It'll be a challenge, but hopefully it'll be enjoyable, I think. I don't know.
Have you, I guess in a way this sort of starts to answer the next question. You've been a part, I named some of your credits. Getting On is also another standout show on your resume from the recent past. You've been a part of successful runaway shows before. Family Guy is it's Family Guy. But The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel seems to have a kind of special place. There seems to be an energy around the show, even the way it's coming back and the way my mother talks about it. There's something about it that feels different, at least to me. Are you experiencing this in a different way than other successful shows in the past, or am I perceiving something maybe just on my end?
No, it's very different. I mean, it crosses a lot of boundaries in terms of the demographic of fans. Like every project that I've done, if I'm in an airport and I see somebody approaching me from like across, you know, the tarmac, I could pretty much nail like, oh, this is someone who's going to talk about Lizzie McGuire. Oh, this is probably Mad TV. Like, oh, this is getting on. It felt very specific, these little camps. And now Maisel just feels like it's everyone. It feels like it. Families are watching it together. Couples are watching it together. Of course, women are loving it, but men are loving it. Now, some men, are, you know, say they're dragged into it by girlfriends or wives or mothers or sisters, and then they love it. Like it just kind of has a taste of everything for a lot of people. And I think it's a really optimistic show right now. And we're living in some very dark times. So I think we hit on a very opportune moment, I think.
It's also such a beautiful show too. The cinematography and the design elements. So in addition to being a compelling story and a groundbreaker in so many ways, I also appreciate just how beautiful it is.
This show and Family Guy. Family Guy, you know, Seth was so insistent on doing so much of the hand drawing. We have a full orchestra that does all of the musical interstitials. Like, wow. Family Guy and Maisel feel like very kind of like artisanal pieces in many ways. That being said, I do think, yeah, Maisel is the work of art. The people working on it are artists, our costume designer, our production designer, our cinematographer. It is, you know, our prop department, the people that make every matchbook, every cup, every box, every vintage retro period piece that you see on that show, the signage, like those are, that's a prop. You know, the person who does it is called a property manager, and Jose and his team, they do brilliant work. And everyone is like a craftsman. It's really something to watch.
It reminds me of some big ensemble theater that I was a part of right out of acting school, like Restoration Comedies and these big ensemble-driven Chekhovian pieces with the way the world was just so dynamically built. And then, to your point, the property manager and the set designer and the costume designer. And when all of those different elements really rang, the way a show could just stun, maybe this seems like an odd comparison, but the show August Osage County, it was such an ensemble, just titan of a show, but it wasn't just the people on the stage. It was every element of that show is so tight. And when all those things work, Maisel kind of reminds me of theater in that way. It has a vibe of theater in that way. Does it feel at all like theater as someone who does do a fair amount of theater?
Oh, absolutely. I don't do a fair amount of theater. I do very limited amount, but yes, it is very theatrical in its flavor and how we shoot it, the amount of dialogue that we have to memorize. And many times we do shots, we call them a one-er, meaning that it is one single shot from when we enter an apartment and go up. And, you know, we did one in the apartment in season one, going in the midst of Susie seeing her apartment. It's like we did that mostly in one shot, and it's really, really hard. It's very much like theater piece, and if you mess it up, you got to go all the way back to the beginning and start over. And the whole piece feels like a musical without music, really. It has that sense that anyone could break into song at any moment.
How much along this promotional tour are you interacting with fans? Obviously, on social media, you're active, but are you having much interaction with fans during this time?
We have some. You know, we had some people attend our premiere that were just rabid fans. We had people that kind of find out where a lot of our press is and hang out before and after. I had a special event to celebrate the launch of Maisel, as well as this little apparel business I've started called Hennevy's. We had this little party event show, and we did some giveaways to some fans to be able to come to that. So it's always fun to get to see and meet people. There are people that like took a red eye in order to make it to New York to come to this event, and you're just like, wow, you flew from Portland. So people are really, really into it. People really see Midge, I think, as this superhero. It's like, you know, she's kind of the female Marvel character from 1959. People are just getting power from her. They're being fed. There's something really optimistic and yeah, people need it right now.
Is there something about season three, and I'm curious about things from the fans, is there feedback or things you're hearing that are unexpected or surprising, or that you find are resonating in a way that you didn't perhaps expect from the fans and in general the feedback you're receiving?
I think kind of what I just said, that people are kind of seeing so many women are identifying with this friendship between Midge and Susie. But it's also, I'm so surprised. The biggest surprise is how well it does internationally. People interviewing us from India, from Spain, from Italy, from Berlin. It's like, really? A show about Jews in 1959 in New York is a hit in Berlin? It just, it's resonating with so many people. It's cool.
So you mentioned, you know, we're doing this, what is today? Tuesday the 10th, and tomorrow will end this promotional tour. So what happens for you then? Are you back home then and kind of life goes on, or do you have other Maisel-related responsibilities this year and in the coming months?
Well, I'm actually doing a bit of stand-up comedy right now. I'm doing a little tour that's called Alex and the Amster Gang with myself and two musician friends. And we did a show in Barcelona and Madrid. We just did New York for this private, our little Maisel Hennepy's party. We do five shows December 12th through 15th at the Soho Theater.
I don't know what it's like to perform stand-up comedy, but I've heard enough comics talk about taking their shows internationally and how even good material, you go to different countries, even if they speak English, it's just there is a little bit of an adaptation. You have to kind of feel that. Do you agree with that, I suppose? And then if so, too, how have you found it to work this show moving quickly through different parts of the world?
The first time we did it was in May, and it was in New York. It was in Brooklyn. And we altered it. The next show that we did was in Barcelona, and we definitely altered it. There's one piece that kind of, when we first did it, goes through American history. We kind of go through the decades to make a point. And we changed that to be much more of a global historical history lesson as opposed to just being so myopic. And then there's some things that rely on the fact that people won't know what the hell I'm talking about. There's some things that work because it's foreign. There's a lot of stuff that's very universal, talking about, you know, the dissolution of a relationship after a long time, talking about being back on the market again, talking about raising children, talking about a woman's place in this world right now and the political climate everywhere. So it hits on enough things that are very, very common, even in Barcelona compared to Madrid. And then we have a very different response the other night here in New York. And I suspect we land in London on election day. We're going to have a big challenge.
So you're in London the 12th through the 15th of December. And then will Ireland, Scotland, will that be shortly thereafter, or where would that fall in the schedule?
Ireland is February 27th to 29th. Mm-hmm. And Amsterdam, I believe, don't quote me on this, I think it's going to be, it's a Sunday and it might be March 22nd or 21st, whatever that Sunday is. But you can go to theamstergang.com, like a gang that hangs out in Amsterdam, the Amster Gang.
Perfect. And that has all the expected information and how to keep up with, you know, any social media updates and things of that nature, right?
Yeah, we're on Insta, and you can get tickets on that site too.
I'm conscious of our time. And before we say goodbye, yesterday it was announced that Don Rodolini, who we both know and have great affection for, will be taking the interim CEO position at NHF. And I just wanted to kind of get your reaction to that as somebody who has, you know, built a relationship with her over the years and with the organization over the years as well.
I mean, I think it's great. I also loved working with Val and will miss him. And I like, you know, if you have somebody that already is very familiar with the insides and the interior of something, that's a leg up. That's going to be to our advantage, I think.
I agree. I definitely agree. And her energy for everything she does is, I think, going to go a very long way.
I've been a spokesperson for NHF and I've tried to be as involved as I can, but I have not been sitting down in their offices day to day. I don't know what that experience is actually like. So I do wish, I hope it's a great transition.
Is there anything else that you'd like to underscore about season 3 of Maisel? Because I know a lot of people who listen to this watch it, or if they don't watch it, they certainly hear a lot about it. Maybe let's talk to those people. There's listeners here who have certainly heard us talk about The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel before. For those who have maybe still not hit click on their Amazon play button, What do you have to say to them about season three? Why should they jump in now?
I say be careful, because apparently it's addictive. Any comments that I happen to catch online, people are just like, I missed work. I didn't take my kids to school. I would love for people to savor them, because they take so goddamn long to make.
Oh my, I can only imagine.
It's like preparing a gourmet meal and watching someone just like put it in a blender and drink it. It's like, oh, slow down. I get it. People are excited and they want to fix. And this is a season where everyone kind of takes off. Susie has pulled her away from this other life. Susie has said, don't go back to any of these guys. Come with me. I am going to give you the life that you want. Mm-hmm. I'm going to provide for you. I'm going to make you a star. And now it's like, holy crap, can I even do this? I'm terrified. I think I'm operating out of fear, and so is Midge. Midge is like, I got this, but the truth is she's never performed on such a scale and in front of different audiences, and it's terrifying for everyone. But I think that level of excitement is also what makes the season pretty amazing, and it opens up. It becomes hugely diverse, and I mean that in every sense. Midge's tiny little sheltered world on the Upper West Side has exploded, and she's now on tour with Shai Baldwin. She's dipping her toe into the inequity of people of color in 1959. And let's be honest, still to this day, she's her whole world, her worldview is cracking open, and we have this amazing cast that's filling in this new landscape for her, and other characters too. Joel has a really interesting arc this season, and his world completely opens up, and feels like Amy has managed to craft this in a perfect, honest, real way, that like everything's just exploding open, and it's going to be much more inclusive in many ways, and shine a light on the fact that much of the world is not inclusive.
The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel Season 3, now on Amazon Prime. You can binge all 8 episodes of Season 3 and all 3 seasons if you must, but Alex would recommend that you enjoy the gourmet meal and not turn it into a blended drink, if at all possible. TheAmsterGang.com, if you want to check out what Alex is up to when she's not on set, and at Alex Borstein on Twitter. And is that the Instagram handle as well, at Alex Borstein?
It is.
Well, Alex, thank you for making time for this in the midst of a very busy tour. Good luck with the very end of it, and have so much fun with the Amster Gang. I'm tempted to see if I can make my way to visit family in Ireland in late February.
I don't know if you heard the NPR piece, but I talked about Bombardier, so I'm hoping they included it.
Oh, I didn't. I'll have to take a look for that. Thank you.
Yeah, NPR Fresh Air, something like that.
Nice. All right, that'll be great. People will be very excited by that, so I'll certainly keep an eye out. Thanks again. This was a lot of fun, and safe travels.
I'll see you the next thing.
Thank you, Alex, for coming on Bloodstream and giving us a little behind the scenes of the experience promoting The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel Season 3, now available on Amazon Prime, Season 3 of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. You can also check out Alex's interview on NPR's Fresh Air. Unfortunately, that mention of Bombardier Blood that she talked about seems to have been cut, but it is a great interview in which she talks about how hemophilia played a role in her life growing up and in entertainment. So head on over to NPR's Fresh Air to check out the interview on December 9th with Alex Borstein. And as long as I'm sending you to other podcasts, I have to remind you to check out Cheat Codes, a Sickle Cell podcast, as well as Bloodstream Journeys, featuring stories, moments of decision that shape the lives of people affected by bleeding disorders. Bloodstream Journeys, as well as Cheat Codes, a Sickle Cell podcast, and Fresh Air from NPR. Thanks again, Alex. Quick programming note, I was not able to coordinate with Mama Sue in time for this month, but I promise we will be back next month with Mama Sue's Streaming Rex. And don't worry, in just a moment, you're going to hear from Natalie and I our top holiday film classics in case you needed help choosing what to put on the television this holiday season. Okay, Natalie, just before we call it a wrap on December, a wrap on Bloodstream Podcast 2019, we're going to bring back an old favorite, the parting shot. One last thing to leave our listeners with, bleeding disorders related or otherwise, but this month we're bringing it back specifically to talk holiday movies. As mentioned by our friend Sam in the Like segment, movies can be your friend in the holidays, give you something to engage with your family with, or family over without having to directly engage. But what holiday movie should you think to put on? There are so many to choose from. There's so many classics, so many competing interests when it comes to holiday movies. Fortunately, we have two resident experts here, and we are happy to share with you our favorite holiday movies. Natalie, give us your top three holiday movies.
Okay, my top three fall in three different categories.
Oh, good.
Category one, cartoon.
Okay.
And my top cartoon is A Charlie Brown Christmas.
Great selection. Classic.
Love it. And then classic movies, my top movie is It's a Wonderful Life.
Merry Christmas, Emporium!
You knew I was going there.
Of course.
And then if we're going to go to rom-coms, I am a Love Actually fan.
Hey, I mean, why not? Although I have to say, as much I've watched that movie like every year around Christmas for most years, I feel like every time it gets a little slower, though. Just a little bit slower.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that there was a time where it was really, really, really good. And, you know, sometimes over time, movies don't quite... Like, It's a Wonderful Life, I feel like every year, is still really, really good. And that's why it 100%. Falls under classical Christmas movies.
100%.
But I, yeah.
I don't think there's a better rom-com. Is there a better Christmas rom-com than Love Actually?
I don't know.
I don't think there is.
I don't know.
Mailbag at bloodstreammedia.com.
What are yours?
All right, great suggestions. So I didn't categorize them. I just went to stuff I like.
Okay.
And the first one, National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. Absolute classic. Clark Griswold at it again, lighting himself on fire, killing cats inside a tree. It's got all the holiday magic you could possibly ask for. They kidnap a person. It's wonderful. Speaking of kidnapping, that's my theme for my holiday movies. Home Alone. Home Alone. Excellent, excellent, excellent. And Home Alone 2. You can actually lump them together if you want as a one and two. They're both holiday movies. They both have different values. The second one takes place in New York City is very fun. The first one is the first one. Kevin McAllister is like, he's so small. We realized
he's so
recently rewatched
and so cute.
My goodness. And lastly, debated as a Christmas movie, but not in this household, Die Hard. The very first Die Hard, which is absolutely, unquestionably a Christmas movie and one of the best of all time.
What?
So my three, Christmas Vacation, Home Alone, and Die Hard. Natalie, yours?
Well, I just had a fourth one pop into my head.
What is that?
Prancer. I love Prancer so much. Didn't I make you watch that last year for the first time? You never saw it before?
I don't remember.
Well, it's so good.
I guess we're going to have to look at it again. I think you did, but I'm really drawing a blank.
It's really magical.
Okay, so Prancer. Prancer's on the list too. You got seven, so no excuses. You got plenty of movies to choose from, but start with Die Hard. And that
is all
for this episode. Special thanks to everyone at Believe Limited, the National Hemophilia Foundation, Entertainment to Effect Change, the Hemophilia Alliance, our presenting sponsor, Takeda, as well as our like segment sponsor, Genentech. Subscribe to the Bloodstream Podcast and the Ask the Expert Podcast and Cheat Codes, a sickle cell podcast, on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Leave us a rating, share our shows, and help spread the word. You can email us at mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com. Check out the new website, bloodstreammedia.com. You'll also find Bloodstream on facebook.com/bloodstreammedia and at Bloodstream Info on Instagram and Twitter. Reminder to check out the program notes for this episode in your podcast player or on bloodstreammedia.com for links and additional information about various stories featured on this episode. My name remains Patrick James Lynch.
And I'm Natalie Lynch.
And until next year, take self-care of yourself.
Until next decade.
Until next decade, 2020, coming soon. Oh, that sounds like the future. Bye, everybody.